This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Folks, it is time to talk about one of my absolute favorite topics, snacks. Japanese snacks, specifically. You know, ever since I was a young lad who discovered the world of Japanese snacks, I've been obsessed with their adorable packaging, quirky vibes, and the incredible flavors that you just cannot find in U.S. supermarkets. That is why teaming up with our sponsor, Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute blast. Because these snacks aren't just your average grocery store finds. Every month, Boxu delivers over 20 unique treats straight from Japan. Plus, they include a handy guide filled with info about each snack and Japanese culture. Snacking and learning, literally my two favorite things, and I'm going to take a wild guess that those are two things you enjoy as well. Oh, and did I mention that each box ships free from Japan straight to your doorstep? It's incredible. And these snacks are so special, okay? One of them that I just cannot get out of my mind, they have this white chocolate strawberry. It's like a freeze-dried strawberry that is somehow injected with white chocolate. So it is both simultaneously strawberry and white chocolate. I cannot even describe to you what this tasted like. I have never had a textural or taste sensation like it. You gotta try it. And my favorite thing about Boxu, besides the amazing snacks, is that they support small, family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love Japanese snacks as much as I do, or if you know someone who does, you have got to try out Boxu. Right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. And let me know what you think of that strawberry. It is seriously good.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to Factually. I'm Adam Conover. Thank you so much for joining me once again as I talk to an incredible expert about all the amazing things that they know that I don't know and that you might not know. Both of our minds are going to get blown together today. We're going to have a lot of fun doing it. Now, if you hadn't noticed, we're in the middle of a full-blown stage 3 code red hype cycle. Its subject, artificial intelligence. To see how deep the hype hole goes, just type the phrase AI will transform into your search bar, and you'll see articles about how AI will transform lives and labor markets, how AI is set to transform the construction industry, how AI and machine learning will transform your legal department. Even an article that dares to ask, can AI transform the skincare buying experience? You know, as if I need a large language model to understand the importance of moisturizing. Please, I know how to take care of my skin. Now, it's not like generative AI isn't a real thing, or that there aren't good and bad, maybe very bad repercussions to come from its development and adoption. We're in early days. It's just that this current wave of hype and those headlines promising transformation in every conceivable sphere, well, it's something we've seen before, and it is bullshit. Remember the good old days of 2022? Well, that year was filled with headlines about the metaverse, like, will the metaverse really transform our lives? Or how the metaverse could change work? And of course, you guessed it, how the beauty industry is entering the metaverse. Okay. Well, as we all know, Mark Zuckerberg's multi-billion dollar gamble on the metaverse was a total flop. Even the Wall Street Journal talked trash with the headline, the metaverse is quickly turning into the metaverse. Get it? They're up with the kid lingo over there. Well, the metaverse wasn't even the tech industry's only hype wave to crash on the rocky shores of reality last year, because cryptocurrency also went up in flames. The industry's resident genius, Sam Bankman-Fried, turned out to be a wildly corrupt and incompetent fraudster who is now awaiting trial. And the crypto collapse didn't just hurt something that doesn't matter much, like Mark Zuckerberg's ego. It had serious consequences. It wiped out $2 trillion in value in 2022. And many of those vaporized dollars belonged to normal people who had bet the farm on the crypto hype cycle. So why do we have these repeated hype cycles over and over again? Well, here's the fundamental problem. The tech industry is structured around having a new, completely transformative technology roll out every 2 years or so. But after the invention of the internet, smartphones, GPS, and the mobile internet, they've started to run out of low-hanging fruit to blow our minds with. A lot of the important technological innovations have now already been made, so these companies now have to resort to telling us over and over again that whatever new magic potion they've come up with is going to solve all of our problems. And, you know, some of it might turn out to be magic, but at least some of it is turning out to be snake oil. So, whenever we're caught up in a tech industry hype cycle tornado, like the AI one we are in right now, we need to remember that this hype is being created by huge corporations and investors who have a financial stake in us buying into the bullshit. And for that reason, it's important that we all remain skeptical, to keep our critical thinking faculties intact so that we can dissect the hype to figure out what is real and what is fake. And our guest today is absolutely brilliant at doing just that. His name is Dan Olson, and his video essays on the YouTube channel Folding Ideas are essential viewing, whether he's ripping apart NFTs or the metaverse. So I cannot wait to talk to him about what he has learned about tech industry hype cycles and how they might help us think a little bit more critically about those yet in our future. But before we get to that conversation, I just want to remind you that if you want to support this show, you can do so on Patreon. Just head to patreon.com/AdamConover. For $5 a month, you get every episode of this show ad-free. Plus, you can join our community Discord. We even do a live book club every couple months where we read a book together and discuss it. It is so much fun. We'd love to see you there. And of course, if you enjoy stand-up comedy, don't forget that I am going on tour this year. If you live in Illinois, Maryland, Missouri, or Rhode Island, please come see me do my brand new hour of stand-up in a city near you. Head to adamconover.net/tour dates to get those tickets. And now, without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Dan Olson. Dan, thank you so much for being on the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
I've admired your videos for so long. You had a huge video about crypto and NFTs came out last year, right? Yep. And when I say huge, I'm talking, it was like 2.5 hours long, something like that, wasn't it? It's a very long, you make very long YouTube videos.
218.
Okay. And you have a new one out about the metaverse.
Yeah.
Came out just a month ago. And so I'm curious, what got you into making these videos? Because there's something that both of those have in common, right? About there's some themes shared between them. What is it that attracts you to these topics?
So the big thing is narrative. Like these are subjects that are effectively like they're products that exist almost entirely as this narrative that runs both in parallel to and ultimately like sort of the point of the videos, disconnected from sort of the reality of what they are.
Yeah.
You know, you have this story that's being used to sell them, but the disconnect between the story and the actual thing is just this immense gulf. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, it's, and by the way, it's impossible not to bring up AI as we talk about those two things. I see the similar gulf there where people talk about, oh my God, here's what these are, whether metaverse, crypto, or AI, here's what these products are going to be used for in just 2 years. They're going to change the world. And then you look at the technical details of what they actually do.
Yeah.
Whether it's what the blockchain literally does, how it's used in practice today, or what a large language model, which is the technology that everyone's excited about, how it literally works. And you immediately have trouble connecting A to B, connecting the two ends together to see how the possible use cases that people are floating have anything to do with the technology at all. I mean, is there a particular example from, say, the metaverse video that leaps out to you of what people say is possible versus what actually is?
I mean, just the like it's difficult because to pull out a specific example. I mean, probably the big one would be like this, the rhetoric, the narrative of like people are going to like move into like they're going to move to the metaverse. They're going to move into the metaverse. And we use sort of the language of like, you know, living online, like being too online and whatnot. But the thing is, but this the disconnect ends up being that you get this narrative of like moving to the metaverse. You know, people are living in the metaverse, but they're not. You know, they're I don't live in World of Warcraft. I don't live on Twitter. You know, even if we say it like, you know, metaphorically, we know that it's a metaphor. And the problem is that the metaphor of like move to the metaverse, we should be able to cut through that pretty easily, because it's like, it's a website. It's a tool. And so the question of like, are we like, so really that metaphor is saying, one, it's either just completely incoherent because your body won't fit inside your computer. Or if we take it metaphorically, it's saying that it's like, this is going to be a medium by which we engage with a whole bunch of other like specific use cases. And it's like, okay, but that second one is a lot more boring and it's also falsifiable. We can look at that and we can say like, okay, wouldn't it be cool if a website was three-dimensional and like you could put on a VR headset and wander around inside a website or like whatever that like implies. But the thing is, sure. We've been trying that since the 90s, you know.
Yeah, I remember VRML.
Yeah, VRML. You know,
it was a very rudimentary VR markup language for websites from the late 90s that never took off. But yeah. I remember reading Wired magazine in like 1998 and reading about it.
And Wired has they've got a great postmortem on it from about 18 months ago on VRML and like kind of like what became of it. And like the fact that it is sort of like still around is this very niche like hobby sort of thing. And so the thing is we've been trying this for decades and we know that at the end of the day, text and like being able to flatten a website and being able to interact via buttons and hypertext and all of these things. And like, you know, you have a cursor that you can use to hover over things and that can pop up new information and all of that.
Yeah.
That level of like abstract interaction is incredibly powerful and more useful for more contexts. Just so many contexts that it's like Twitter is not going to be a better experience if it's three-dimensional. Ordering stuff like an online store, we tried 3D online stores that you walk around and look at, and then it's like, ah, but it turns out if we just create like a flat page with a grid of like product images and short little text descriptions, we can fit in so much more information. Because at the end of the day, like the benefit of going to something in the store is like the tactile nature of the product that you're looking at. Like you can touch it, you can see it, you can feel it, you can weigh it. And it's like all the metaverse stuff, they gesture towards that. You know, Mark Zuckerberg having his presentation where he's in a fencing match against someone. And it's like, yeah, but it's not going to play out that way because you will never be able to like physically interact with someone via the medium. No one will ever be able to shove you in the metaverse and make you fall over in your house on the other side of the world. That's just, I mean, physically impossible.
There's so many ways in which, and you've name checked like five of them, that people who are promoting these technologies seem to fundamentally misunderstand reality when they're promoting the technology. And it's a number of different types of realities. You just mentioned, for instance, the reality of being a physical being instantiated in the world.
Yeah.
Right. And the ways in which, you know, that extends past just, okay, I have a screen on my eyes and I've got some gloves on, right? Yeah. That can maybe interact with my fingers. Being extended in reality, there's a lot more senses than that. There's proprioception, your sense of, I think I'm pronouncing it right.
Proprioception, where your hands are relative to your body. Yeah.
Yeah. Where your physical body is, stuff like that, that no set of goggles is ever going to be able to reproduce. And so there's that misunderstanding. Then there's the misunderstanding of how people actually use technology.
Yeah.
As you say, the reason Amazon was able to, dominate online retail wasn't because they made a facsimile of a physical store. It's because they realized the most important thing was being able to buy stuff as quickly as possible. I have a thought that I need a thing with Amazon. If I'm an Amazon power user, I can buy it within 30 seconds and have it shipped to my house and stop thinking about it. Whereas if you have to like have a virtual avatar that's wandering around in a store, it's going to take a million years. The point is the convenience. And then the last thing they seem to misunderstand is how these businesses actually, how real life businesses actually work. One of the things that shocked me the most about the metaverse was the claim that you used to see it all the time. If I got an item in one video game, I could then bring it to any other video game. And like, I was like, the people making this claim, I guess, don't play video games.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't like, make business sense. It doesn't make technological sense.
It doesn't make video game sense. Like, okay, so I'm playing Diablo and I get a sword in Diablo and I want to bring that sword to Zelda Breath of the Wild, right?
Yeah.
Well, the game mechanical effects of that sword in Diablo are completely different than in Zelda, right? The weapons work fundamentally differently. In Zelda, they're physical objects that you can throw and have, you know, they're extended in space. In Diablo, they're basically like just little, you know, it's all about the stats, right?
Yeah.
And the effects that it has. So that would require, if that were to actually happen, Diablo could create an item. Every single item in Diablo would have to be recreated in Zelda by the people at Nintendo to like, okay, what did this lightning spear do in Diablo? Okay, how do we make that make sense in Zelda? And then there'd have to be a hook to have every single one of those items come in. And Nintendo's not going to fucking do that.
No.
Because they don't give a shit about taking items from Diablo and putting it in Zelda or whatever else. The amount of work it would create for an extremely marginal benefit. Like, how does it benefit Nintendo or anybody playing a Nintendo game to bring in a thing from it? So it's just like, it's a failure to think through the basics of what your own proposal entails is sort of the shocking thing that is lacking in these, in all these predictions about crypto, metaverse, and I would argue AI as well, though we can get there in our conversation.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense as a business decision. It doesn't make sense as a technological claim, and it doesn't make sense as a creative claim. Like that it's like it.
Yeah.
The thing that this is probably that third one is probably the one that rankles me the most about those kind of claims is that it's like it denies intentionality to things that people create. And this goes for like this is a big thing in like a lot of the AI pushers as well, is that it's like, well, it fails to consider that people make a video game. Humans make a video game in order to say something. In order to create a specific type of experience, in order to have a world and interactions and emergent properties and instrumental elements and all of this, and that interacting with those is fun and rewarding. Yeah.
and players play the game in order to experience that experience.
Those things,
you know,
yeah.
Like okay, so a good example of this that just came out yesterday. Speaking about AI. Was this just hit, I think, Twitter yesterday. The NVIDIA CEO unveiled, did you see this video? Their new AI NPC.
no.
This was like it was a keynote address by the CEO of NVIDIA. Apparently a big deal because he doesn't give addresses very often. And so he unveils this tech where you go talk to an NPC in like a cyberpunk style video game.
Okay.
And you use your real voice to talk to him. You say, hey, Steve, what's up? And then Steve goes, I'm not feeling so great. There's a bunch of criminals in the area and they're being controlled by a mob boss. And you say, oh, where can I find the mob boss with your actual voice? And they go, oh, well, you can make a left down there. And he's, you know, et cetera. The guy talks back to you. But it's talking back to you via a large language model.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which means it's not scripted. They've like, you know, they've given it a bunch of text and it's giving you text based on your, you know, it's processing of what you've said to it. And so according to the CEO of NVIDIA, a very important video game company, a very important company in video gaming, this is how we're going to talk to NPCs in the future. I'm watching this going, no, we're fucking not.
No.
Like, because as soon as you give a video game player a completely unbounded text input where they can say whatever they want, all they're going to ask it is like, what color the president's dick is, you know, or like, hey, would you, they're going to ask it to perform sex acts with them. They're just going to talk to it about nonsense all day long. They're going to try to get it to say weird stuff. They're not, the quest isn't even going to come up. Right. And that's all that they're creating. Every single NPC is going to be a bizarre conversational sandbox where you try to trick the AI into doing weird stuff.
Yeah.
That becomes a completely different type of video game. An NPC quest giver is there to give you a quest. So you have something interesting to do. Gameplay only works because of constraints that are placed on the player and the lack of understanding about that from a CEO for a very important company in the gaming space was a kind of astounding to me that he didn't watch his own demo going, well, this game would fucking suck. You know, like what I've presented. maybe there is a use of large language models in video games, but yeah. It's certainly not what they presented.
No. Just to point to a very basic thing with that, like when the Nintendo Wii and DS came out, you know, they had integrated sort of stuff like they had integrated multimodal interactions. So, you know, shout into the microphone in order to do a thing in WarioWare. And people, you have fun with it the first couple of times, like talking to your DS, and then you realize that like, oh, it's just looking for like literally any input at all. And I can just blow on it. I can just blow on the microphone so that if I'm playing on the train, I'm not sitting there chatting to my video game, but I can still play it. Like, so it's this kind of like lack of understanding of like the actual physical act of interacting with the software that sort of seems to elude a lot of these people in a very bizarre way, where it's like you're in charge of a very big part of the industry and you don't seem to understand just like why people would find this awkward and weird. Makes it very clear that it's like they have literally never taken even 5 minutes to get someone who is not a yes man to like interact with the thing. Because as you said, like, okay, let's just pull in three random Redditors, give them access to this thing, make the NPC female, and realize our mistake very quickly.
Yeah. And it's also a complete misunderstanding of how the product that they're talking about is made. They don't know anything about how video games are made. They don't know what design is. And not to get too far afield, but I see the exact same thing in the ideas about replacing TV writers, which is what I do with AI as well. People who think that that's possible don't understand how television is made. They don't understand what writing is. They don't understand what the job of a writer is. We don't need to get too much into that. I want to ask you about your last video. You explored one of the metaverses that has had the most extravagant claims about it made, Decentraland.
Yeah.
And if you could just summarize what you found, what was the gap between promise and reality there?
Oh, the gap between promise and reality in Decentraland is the Grand Canyon lengthwise. It's kind of monumental. Decentraland has been struggling and kind of it was limping along and on like the verge of death. It was saved by Mark Zuckerberg. It was
What was it initially pitched as?
Initially pitched as a virtual reality space. Basically an MMO with user generated content, and a real estate model. So you would purchase
on the blockchain, right?
On the blockchain. Yeah. A crypto product. So it has its own crypto coin. It has multiple, crypto tokens that signify various other things. So one of them, the most important one, is land. So you have this artificial scarcity of this digital city. People purchase plots and then they build on the plots using, you know, various like model construction construction software.
This sounds extremely similar to the video game Second Life, which again I played in 2002.
Was
a game with it's a 3D virtual world where you can buy land and you can sell products on it for fake digital currency. And this seemed like basically the same idea plus blockchain. I enjoyed Second Life.
VR Second Life plus blockchain was kind of the pitch in its initial form. And then it turned out that like the developers just simply weren't skilled enough to produce even a tenth of what they had promised. and so it was very much like, you know, just the we have McDonald's at home, and then, you know, McDonald's at home is just like two slices of bread with some bologna. The gulf was wide, and the claims just like very, very like quickly got winnowed down. VR just sort of like quietly disappeared from the things that this thing that it was supposed to be, even though that was a foundational claim. And that one's like astounding to me because, you know, knowing what I like, I'm not a game dev, but I have like dabbled in it. And I just like knowing how things are made. So I watch a lot of documentaries about game production. I follow a lot of game designers on Twitter. And I love like listening to like, you know, GDC talks and whatnot. Like, I'm just fascinated by that stuff. And so the simple fact that like VR went away so quickly, it was like, oh, you were never actually building that, because VR, yeah. Like I'm a VR aficionado. I like VR. I spend a pretty like decent amount of like just personal time, like playing, you know, Beat Saber and stuff like that. And the thing that, you know, if you actually like engage with VR as a product, like as an actual existing product, is that it's like there has to be a very high degree of intentionality, that things that are sloppily converted into a VR mode are just like awful. Like, even if it was a first person experience, like it cannot just be like haphazardly ported. And so there are some things that started as like regular FPS games and got a pretty good VR port, but there's tons that are just like unplayably bad because they lack that level of intentionality.
Yeah, if they weren't designed for VR from the bottom up, it's like not worth putting the headset on. I mean, I've played games that I really loved in, you know, on the screen, but I didn't enjoy playing them on VR because I was like, it's not really worth the nausea for this experience.
Yeah.
Versus something like, you know, Beat Saber, which is like designed explicitly for VR. It's a game that can only work in that context.
And like No Man's Sky is kind of my point too, because like their first version of VR No Man's Sky was like unplayably bad. And then they put a lot of work into it, and now it's playable, and like cruising around in your spaceship in VR super rules. Everything outside of your spaceship is like, well, this is playable.
Mm-hmm. And like I can see it, but it's like, if I'm actually mining for resources, maybe I'll take the headset off and do it the old fashioned way.
Yeah. Because it's like, it's a lot slower. You face a lot more like performance bottlenecks. You know, the gameplay is just a lot less interesting when you're like teleporting around a planet, just like zoop, zoop, zoop.
Oh, it's like using node-based movement.
It uses node. Yeah. And you can use freeform movement if you enjoy the taste of your carpet and would like to have a very close and personal experience with the ground in the next like 15 seconds. But like, you know, and you can see that lack of intentionality, because like the movement in No Man's Sky, if you're just playing the base version of the game, is tremendous fun. There's a great like sense of like inertia and physicality to it. You're jumping around, you're using your jetpack. You know, exploration in that game is just it's a delight. You can just do it for hours. You can get lost on some no-name planet that like doesn't even have anything you want, and just waste hours exploring because moving around is enjoyable. Yeah. And so the VR version of it has to strip so much of that out that it's like, okay, what's the point anymore?
And so vis-a-vis Decentraland, you sort of realize quickly that, well, they never had any intention.
They
of
never
actually
had any real intention. Yeah. If they were able to strip it out as easily as they did, then it's like they were never like seriously trying to make it, because it's not something that you can just like, oh, well, we'll build the like third person version first and then we'll work on the VR. And it's like, no, you could maybe go the other direction, but like,
yeah.
But that you're doing this in just fundamentally the wrong order. Your product is never like it said that like emotionally they ruled out VR years before they ever officially like dropped it from the website.
Or they never knew what it took to actually put it in, and they were saying it, you know, glibly. Oh, well, it'll be VR, without actually having any cognizance.
Because like Snow Crash is virtual reality. So, of course, it's going to be VR because we're building Snow Crash. And it's like, okay, they had no idea of what that actually meant.
And this is meant to be one of the main like flagship crypto metaverse projects that people invested a ton of money into, it, my understanding is.
Yeah.
But when you go and actually explore it, it's like, yeah, it's sad trombone. It's like this is garbage. This is sad. It's kind of a bummer. There's so little to do. It's so janky.
Yeah. And one of the big things that you see, like just from the software side, like going back to this notion of like deliberateness in the production of things, that it's like that Decentraland posits this idea of VR, you know, the Ready Player One, like all video games are just one giant video game. You know, they're all based on the same backbone. And Decentraland shows us this, like, oh, that's actually like just kind of a bad idea. because your base layer is going to impose creative and technical decisions onto then everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to have a physics model that then everyone needs to like start with and then modify in order to build what they want. And that's going to like have an indelible effect on everything down the road. And that means that if an update like changes how gravity works ever so slightly, every game.
Mm-hmm.
Everything built on top of it is then like impacted.
Yeah.
The lighting model, the rendering engine, like all of these things, like those change.
But it sort of fits this fantasy that a lot of these tech CEOs have where like, oh, everything in the future will run on my product, whether that's Unreal Engine or my crypto blockchain or my, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, whatever he believes himself to be building. So you said Decentraland was saved by Zuckerberg. I actually didn't realize that. In what sense was it saved?
Because of the whole pivot that they did, you know, renaming to Meta and announcing that they had dumped like literally billions of dollars into developing the metaverse. Suddenly, like metaverse as a pitch word just massively takes off. And so all of the speculators then go like, oh, what else is like a possible metaverse like thing? Where is metaverse? What is metaverse? How can we metaverse? Do I have a metaverse? Are you a metaverse? And so Decentraland, which had been like limping very slowly towards its grave for a year up to like for all, a year already up to that point, suddenly sees this like huge resurgence in the value of Mana, which is their crypto token. You know, a whole bunch like land sales suddenly spike as people. I mean, a big thing was actually just a wave of people who were like trying to be super early because they're like, I bet people stupider than me are going to not know what Mark was talking about. They're gonna not realize that Decentraland isn't the Facebook product, and they're just gonna like buy this crap and I can flip it for a quick buck.
Yeah. And presumably some of them were able to do that.
Yeah.
And that's been the story of crypto for the last couple of years entirely until it finally, you know, we seem to have entered a longer period of crashing. But I mean, that pivot that Facebook did was so massive to call themselves Meta, to pour, what, at this point, tens of billions of dollars into developing something that sucks, that nobody wants. And I did a video on this as well. I talked about it much more briefly than you did. But like the amount of money, the sheer amount of money that Zuckerberg has poured into this while creating such, talking about Horizon Worlds, his metaverse, such a turd of a product. Like I've used it. It's unplayable. There's nothing.
At best, fine. Like
it's worse than Second Life was in 2002. It's worse. It looks worse. It plays worse. You can do less in it. There's less people using it. And he's not just invested so much money into it. He changed the name of the fucking company. And by the way, he changed it. And now nobody talks about the metaverse at all.
No.
It's been like, it's been like 9 months. And now people have moved on to AI entirely. And he's having to repivot the company. And he's literally out there going, well, now Meta is an AI company.
Oh, it's beautiful. Does he have to change
the name of the company again?
It brings a tear to my eye. It's just so beautiful. He's such a loser. He's just, he got, he got lucky once with an idea that like 50 other people were all trying, 50 other people, hundreds of people on the planet all knew that something Facebook-esque was about to like,
yeah,
you know, somebody just needed to crack that nut and he just happened Friendster, to hit it at MySpace. The right angle. Yeah.
Yeah. He was the one who did it right. He was just bloodthirsty enough. You know, he bought up enough of his competitors. He killed enough competitors in the crib and he was able to like, you know, build a monopoly that everybody hates.
And then he lied to literally all of us in the media about Pivot to Video and fed us just bad numbers and killed our websites. But out of that, like, convinced himself that he is, in fact, you know, a modern techno emperor who is philosophically, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, genetically fit to rule humanity. And then just to take an L of this size is poetic.
And to personally take the L.
Yeah.
Not to shit on it's Mark
not
too
just
much.
The, yeah. It's not it, just the company. It's not like it's like, oh, the company made some weird decisions. It's like he put himself out there as like the face of it. And like
he's personally,
assured that like it's like the doubt. Like I have whipped the doubters in the company into line. This is my vision. Like he put his fingerprints all over it in public. And just it's beautiful.
It's so diluted. I mean, even the fact that he's the guy hosting the concept videos, right? Who thinks that Mark Zuckerberg is the guy we all want to be like?
Oh.
The guy we all want to hear from, the guy who's going to explain this to us. Like, I guess he must believe himself. I'm Steve Jobs. I'm one, you know, everyone reveres me, but everyone hates his fucking guts and everyone thinks he's a loser. Like, The right wing hates him. The left wing hates him. Like, everybody on earth hates the guy. He goes to Congress. He gets yelled at and sweats, you know, like he's not. And look, you know, maybe not everybody has to be good on camera, you know, to be a valid person on earth. But why does he think that he is bizarre? I mean, fucking hire Shaq to do it.
Yeah.
You know, like you can pay Shaq $1 million. He'll say whatever the fuck you want. He'll tell you metaverse is great. Why is Pinocchio out there telling us that? I'm sorry. Now I'm getting personal.
Yeah. 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 Like Bobby Kotick is also an evil billionaire and he has the good sense to like,
right,
not go on camera.
Well, so what is it before we go to break? Like what do you think is the fundamental motivation that would cause Zuckerberg to do this to like, cause he's,
oh, just rock hubris.
I have to give him credit for being a smart guy.
Yeah.
You know, in general, like you would think he would understand that what he's building sucks. Like what is the business motivation for this enormous shitty pivot?
I mean, my hypothetical at the time was that it was a political play in order to bury a bunch of bad debt and like legal culpability for data harvesting. And I don't think
look
that
at the
that's
shiny
been,
thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And that hasn't been like that, like the size of the L does not justify that goal. Though there has been like, and there has been demonstrably like some of that in the intervening time. But I think like, I don't know. I'm fixated on that question as well. I think it might just be a combination of hubris and the dude has gotten to a point where he's so insulated from reality that the numbers don't mean anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the volume of cash that has been put onto a barge, lit on fire and pushed out to sea just doesn't register anymore. And that's the like. Because that and crime are the only things that make any sense to me.
Oh, that he's literally committing crimes of some sort.
Of some sort that we just don't know about yet. Like, you know, because otherwise it just doesn't parse.
Yeah. But he clearly has some compulsion, some impulse, right? Like there's the Facebook growth impulse has always been there to get more and more billions of people signed up. To, you know, his whole thing about bringing the internet to places where there aren't internet, the whole purpose of that is to get more bodies signed up to Facebook, right?
Yeah.
So you can tell he's got some overriding impulse that he's trying to fulfill by doing this.
And probably what that is, like, you know, to kind of back off from the, like, you know, the things that neighbor libel would just be that there is a lot of like, because this applies to a lot of like tech guys, is this sort of regret that they don't have a time machine and they can't go back and like hire Tim Berners-Lee and turn WWW into a walled garden.
Right.
That like that if you had been able to walled garden, you know, if AOL had been just like one, 5 years earlier or had won, then you would be a trillionaire.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of this is just like, okay, we need a new version of the web so that we can get a do over.
Yeah. I also wonder if some of the impulse is the need to create a new frontier.
Yeah.
That these guys are all literally frontier, like oil barons, kind of. They're the people who came out first, dug the wells, mined the shit when no one else was there. Whether you're talking about, you know, Steve Jobs, whether you're talking about Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, they all mined for oil first in a new place. And now the wells are drying up, or they've at least topped out. And they're saying, wait, I need to do that again.
Yeah.
What's the next frontier? And they're pointing at something and declaring, that's the frontier. Everyone's going to go there. And we're all used to that pattern. So we're all going, oh, okay, yeah, I guess that's the new frontier. And then we get there and we're like, this is just like fucking Detroit or whatever. Like, this is just, I've already been here. Second Life already existed. This sucks. Why did you take us? Why did you send the wagon train over here? It's like a weird kind of, it turns into a weird sort of scam to try to reproduce what they've done in the past.
Yeah. I mean, and even that is kind of lightly buying into their narrative. I mean, I definitely think that they think of themselves that way, but you know, that they're buying into that narrative of themselves as pioneers when really like someone else came out, did the hard work, found the oil, died at like, you know, fell off a ladder and died at the bottom of a mine. And they came by and found a hole and a skeleton and went, oh, hey, there's some oil down at the bottom there. You know, there's the old, like, you know, racist adjacent, saying, you know, the pioneers got the arrows, the settlers got the land. That at the end of the day, like Zuckerberg's a settler. He's not a pioneer.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I love that correction. We got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with a lot more from Dan Olson.
Folks, I'm honored to say that the podcast is sponsored this week by The Washington Post. If you're a Factually listener, you're already a person who aims to stay informed, aware, and engaged. But let me bring you in on a little secret. Beside the fantastic guests I have on this show, the number one way that I stay engaged is through reading the news like The Washington Post. Their journalists bring you the facts and provide clarity about what's happening on Capitol Hill, the economy, climate change, foreign policy, and everything else that I and you care about. You know, here on Factually, we love to go deep on topics, and The Washington Post helps me and helps you go deeper on the news that matters most to you. That's why I start my days by warming up my brain by reading great articles from some of the best journalists out there in the Post. In fact, many of my favorite past guests on this show, like Taylor Lorenz and David Weigel, have contributed to The Washington Post. That's how good their journalists are. You know, I've also found that adding The Washington Post app to the home screen on my phone has been a great way to cut my social media time. Instead of scrolling through social media on the bus, I get to learn more about the world around me. It is absolutely incredible and makes that commute time so much more enjoyable and fruitful. I also love the Post's newsletters, like The 7, which is a quick commute read that they send each weekday morning and is also available as a podcast. I even signed up to get the Post's For You newsletter, which sends me my very own personalized roundup of stories every evening based on my interest in reading history. So if all of that sounds good to you, well, now is the time to sign up for The Washington Post. Go to WashingtonPost.com/factually to subscribe for just 50 cents a week for your first year. That is 80% off their typical offer. So this is truly a steal. Once again, that is WashingtonPost.com/factually to subscribe for just 50 cents a week for your first year. Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. You know, I never used to have allergies, but then suddenly in my 30s, I started getting walloped with them every single spring. I'll step outside on a beautiful day, ready to hop on the bus or head down to the podcast studio, and suddenly I have a runny nose, scratchy eyes, and it makes it pretty hard to have a conversation with our guests when I am so bogged down and distracted with allergies. Well, luckily for those of us who live with those symptoms, which now includes me, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. So when I've got a big interview with a big guest, I look for relief with Claritin D. In as little as 30 minutes, I'm refreshed, I'm renewed, and I no longer sound like some kind of cartoon duck. So if you are ready to live life as if you don't have allergies, it is time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. You can find Claritin D at your pharmacy counter, and you don't even need a prescription. So go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. That's Claritin.com. Use as directed.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, we're back with Dan Olson. We're talking about tech hype, the metaverse, crypto, maybe some AI. Do you feel that, you know, having made last year this big video about crypto, this year a big one about metaverse, are these things already in the rear view? I mean, crypto has sort of like the media hype has cooled a lot. Occasionally you see, okay, Bitcoin's up again or whatever, yeah. But it's, you know, no longer are, you know, my friends, you know, begging me to buy Dogecoin. Do you think that bubble has burst, or do you think we're still in the middle of it? Because sometimes it does feel that way.
Yeah. So I'm hesitant to say that the bubble has like truly like burst for the last time, because it's burst before and deflated a whole bunch, and then it like reinflates and whatever. When it comes to crypto, I think crypto is sort of like here to stay in a sense, in the same way that like multi-level marketing is here to stay. Because the thing is that like, so the appeal of crypto of like, okay, we can create a security that we can gamble on out of thin air, and humans love gambling. They have an instinct for risk and gambling, and it's addictive. And the narrative of like get rich quick and all of that is so appealing. So like the floor for spinning up a new coin is like trivial in the scope of things. You can do it in an afternoon. You can wake up at 9 a.m. and have your own crypto coin spun up by dinner time. Starting from like cold start zero just by following tutorials. So because of that like absolute rock bottom floor of access, I think like crypto in some form is just never going to go away. It's always going to be, it will now always be somewhere in the way that like multi-level marketing, you know, multi-level marketing has gone through three different rebrands, from just straight up pyramid schemes to multi-level marketing to like, you know, affiliate marketing, affiliate sales. So I think crypto is going to go through the same thing. You're going to have some, you know, crypto will maybe fall out of vogue as a word, and it'll be unique digital assets, digital non-securities like it. Yeah.
It's going to become endemic like COVID basically, where it's like, oh, it's around, but it's, you feel bad for your friend who's got kind of sucked in like a Mary Kay or like Herbalife salesperson. You're like, oh my God, they started doing that. But it's maybe something that, we'll let the IRS worry about going after the bad actors, and it won't be such a daily annoyance for all of us, basically.
Yeah. So in the same way that like penny stocks, you know, penny stock scams and whatnot, like it'll become just kind of like an endemic thing that you know, gold bug stuff. Every now and then it'll surge back up into like, you know, have another 15 minutes in the spotlight But I think that like the arc of crypto, as we have dealt with it in like 2021, is depleting. My kind of like insane, you know, risky prediction is that like, you know, it's all going to have another big pump, but that pump isn't going to, will be like a lower peak than the previous peak. And that's then just going to start like the multi-year sort of downward slide into irrelevance and just becoming this like niche thing that like people still get sucked into. But yeah,
like I think the name of the Lakers stadium is going to change in the next couple of years. Don't you? Yeah. Like they set crypto.com, they signed like a 10-year deal. And I feel like they're like, uh-oh, how are we going to make the payment for year three?
Yeah.
is a concern for them. My friends who I used to have endless arguments with about crypto, I was like, guys, this is bullshit. They're like, no, you're wrong. We don't have those arguments anymore. And they haven't admitted I was right, but you know, they've hushed up about it a little bit. I started to feel bad when I text them because I'm like, I feel like I'm beating a dead horse. But it feels like what hasn't changed is it feels like a lot of those people have moved on to the new shiny object. And that the sort of recurring cycle of tech hype bubbles has moved from crypto to metaverse to AI and maybe onto something else after that. I mean, do you feel that way or?
Yeah, I mean, and that's demonstrable just by looking at like a vertical analysis of both sentiment and like what people are talking about, like social media sentiment, mm-hmm. Media sentiment, like what people are talking about, what tech blogs are talking about, you know, what hypefluencers on social media, you know, the number of like dot Fs that are now like all about Midjourney every single day is like it's just observable that literally the same people, this is now the thing that they're talking about. And I think it's AI in particular is sort of it's a bit of a trickier one. Like metaverse was like untenable at base concepts. Crypto wasn't going to scale and was laid down by people who were so clearly like desperately self-serving that it was never going to break mainstream. AI is trickier because it has emerged like very slowly out of like useful tools and is now in kind of this like it's in this irrational hype bubble, but it's an irrational hype bubble that better resemble like that actually literally better resembles the dot-com boom where like we have a tool that does something. And so you have a whole bunch of like people rushing in to claim it does everything.
Yeah. And that in the future it's going to do everything like.
Yeah.
Large language models, the first time I played them, I was like, this is very cool. This is cool tech. It's fun to play with and people are using it to do things. But the connection from large language model to what people are claiming it's going to do in the future is like we've invented. I love the comparison people call like GPT and systems like it. A word calculator.
Yeah.
You know, you put words in one end, you can get similar words at the other end. You can use the system to turn one kind of word into another kind of word. You might be able to save yourself some time by doing that or at least get interesting output, you know? But the idea that, well, it's moving so quickly and it's going to replace every single job and we're going to have like, you know, we're very quickly going to have like artificial general intelligence. We're going to have data from Star Trek or, you know, Omnivac from old Isaac Asimov stories is... Like I don't see how you get from A to B, and it's but it is more complicated because there is a core of truth and interesting tech to it.
Yeah.
I wonder is what drives you. I feel like we have similar interest levels in some of this tech in a lot of ways. That like I you know the first time I saw I'm always interested in new technology I love watching, you know, demos of what are the people at SIGGRAPH who come up with new image processing technology every year.
Yeah.
I love watching the demos and going, oh, look at what this is capable of. So when I first see that thing like Midjourney or the very first time I heard about blockchain, I was like, oh, what a neat idea. You could there's one of something digitally that I've never seen that before. You know, normally digital stuff, there's millions of, but this time there's only one. Oh, that's so cool. Or even the idea of the metaverse. The first time I saw Second Life, I was like, wow, neat. I like this. I want to play around with it a little bit. You have that positive reaction, makes you think of the actual possibilities. But then as someone who understands technology, seeing people who understand it less go insane and say things that make no sense, it sort of drives you nuts, right? Is that your motivation for making these videos of like, how are people spinning out so crazy about this thing?
So the thing that if I were to make an AI video, it would not be about the technology itself. It would be about the human interaction with it, because the thing that fascinates me the most is that I see this on Reddit. Like, so I deal with a lot of like conspiracy theorists. The current video that we're in like mid production on is about like financial conspiracies, and like meme stocks and whatnot. And the thing that you see in these circles is people, the only, like, okay, so I have a background in theology, and so I do end up filtering a lot of stuff, maybe unnecessarily, like through that lens. But the only language that makes sense to me is that I see people praying to ChatGPT. That they have a
you think
question.
That's what they're doing?
Yeah, they have a question in their mind, and they petition this thing that they place as a higher power. They approach it as an oracle, and ask it questions, and simply trust what it gives them. They don't see it as a. They don't understand that it doesn't know what a pineapple is. Like that it does not actually, that you can ask it the same question four times in a row and it will give you four different outputs, and you can then ask it to, like, you can try to have a conversation with it and be like, hey, what did we talk about like 10 minutes ago? Can you just sum up the thing that you said to me earlier? And it's just going to give you nonsense out of it, because it doesn't actually, like, it's not actually intelligent. It doesn't know what any of these things are, but we have humans interacting with it and trusting it and utilizing it as though it is. And that is fascinating and also scary. And so, like, as a content creator, you know, the thing that sort of does scare me about like AI gonna take creative jobs is that we look at something like TikTok, we look at Facebook videos. If you're not familiar with like the sort of community, like the local dialect of Facebook native video, it is insane. It's just, it'll be these like 20-minute videos that consist entirely of denied gratification. So they're like building up to something.
Oh, I've seen these.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's someone going, oh, and then folks, when I finally take the top off the bottle and everything comes, it's gonna be so beautiful. Here we go.
And they're doing that for like 20 minutes straight. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I've seen these. Yeah.
That there is a part of our lizard brain that is entranced by that. And this race to the, like, there is a very financially profitable race to the bottom in being able to churn out just low quality garbage at scale.
Yeah.
And so, and you and I can sit here and make a very good argument that it's like, audiences don't want mass produced derivative slop that is cranked out by a robot that doesn't know what it's doing. And that is true. People don't want that, but they will still drink it.
This is the question. This is the open question to me about AI, right? Because I agree with you. When people say, oh, everything's going to, you know, AI is going to make all content in the future, I'm like, the main thing it seems useful for is making spam, essentially. Yeah. You can make endless amounts of content that looks like other content. You're talking about spam generation.
Yeah.
And so that's my fundamental reason why I am less concerned about, people are like, oh, AI is going to like make scripts for movies. No movie studio is going to spend $50 million shooting something that an AI
wrote. Yeah.
Yeah. And
what
frankly,
they are going to do is they're going to have an AI spit out something, and then they're going to underpay someone to edit.
Exactly
it.
Right. That's exactly the concern. And that's what, in the Writers Guild right now, we're on strike partially in order to make a provision to make sure they can't, you know, use AI to undermine our working conditions in that way. Right.
Yeah.
But OK, so you might say, well, the movie studio is not going to do that. They're just going to use AI to create the entire film, like from, you know, from moment to moment. And I'm like, that if the production cost is zero, then they're going to sell it to you for zero. Right. the movie industry, the American movie industry, is one of the is the high end of American media production.
Yeah.
It costs the most both to produce and to watch. You know, it costs you $15 to go see it in the theater. And that is, it's the luxury car of media.
Yeah.
You know,
and they like that. They like that relationship. They like being able to say, like, that confers status, and they like having that status, and they don't want to give that up.
And and people enjoy watching media like that too. They want the luxury car experience sometimes. Sometimes you want chum, and that's when you open TikTok, right? And so you're right that that's what AI is going to affect. Like, AI is going to affect the low end first, in terms of, you know, where AI content might be. But then also, I don't know, is that what people really want? So like a low end kind of chum media that we currently have is like music on the radio, you know, pop music. Muzak has existed for a long time, right?
Yeah.
And it's what plays in the grocery store. And so maybe we'll have AI music in the grocery store. But like when it comes to what people listen to on the radio, what, you know, what people want in terms of music coming out, they still want something new and weird that they haven't heard before. And, you know, part of the reason when I'm on TikTok, I skip past the videos where it's just someone going, oh, this filter does X, Y, Z, right? The videos that I want are the weird moments of surprise and serendipity. The guy drinking the Sunny D riding the skateboard, you know, was like, what was fun about that video that made TikTok explode was, who the fuck is this guy and where is he? Why is he riding a skateboard on the side of a freeway? Why is this dude listening to this Fleetwood Mac song? You know, there's like knowing that he existed in the real world was the appeal of that video. And I do think that it's something that people still want, even on the low level. They want that weird human chunkiness to some extent.
Yeah. And that video is a great example because it captures something that, like, because AI doesn't understand what it's doing because it's not intelligent, it couldn't create something like that to the degree it did, because essentially what that video did, you know, you've got this guy in SoCal on a longboard on the freeway at sunset, drinking cranberry juice, listening
cranberry
to
juice, not Sunny Delight. I'm so sorry.
drinking cranberry juice, listening to Fleetwood Mac. And it's like, it taps into this essence of like a perfect moment of you watch it and you're like, God, I want to be spiritually there right now. Yeah. I want to like, you look at it and it's like, that feels free.
Yeah.
And like a perfect moment. And that's what made that video so appealing, was it was just this like perfect sort of like great weather, you know, beautiful view, the wind in your hair, and Fleetwood Mac. And that kind of like those things are emergent from just like human creativity and the ability to spot a moment.
Yeah.
Or construct a moment.
And you know, TikTok has created already a perfect system for getting moments like that for free.
Yeah.
Right. In that they have created an app that encourages people to upload content all day long. I saw a video like that yesterday that I went nuts for, where a 12-year-old kid is on a bike. Maybe people on TikTok have seen this video. 12-year-old kid is on a bike. He's parked the bike. He says, I pulled over. I saw a fucking minion. And what he does is he runs into a bar, right, where there's a group of adults, like people who are 35, sitting inside. And one of them is wearing a yellow shirt and blue overalls. And he runs up to the guy and he goes, Gru isn't here, bro. Gru is not here. And the entire group of adults starts laughing because a 12-year-old has run in and started bullying one of their friends.
Yeah.
Right. And they start yelling, send us this video. Send us the video, as the kid runs away. And it's so fucking funny.
Yeah.
Right. This is a kid. Now, the only reason that video exists is TikTok created an app that incentivized every 12-year-old in America to give them random content for free. Nothing else the kid has ever done has been funny. Right. So I'm kind of like, what is the point of even generating that content via AI when they're already getting so much of it for free? It's kind of like
it's computationally cheaper to just like distribute that out to the crowds for free because like, you know, it takes less bandwidth. It takes less teraflops. Yeah. It takes less electricity.
They'd have to pay electricity to run, you know, large video production models or whatever to create this shit. It kind of reminds me of when, you know, Uber was telling people they were going to replace all the drivers with AI drivers and robot cars. It's like, well, hold on a second. Currently, in order to do that, Uber would have to like build and develop a fleet of robot cars that they personally own.
They own and maintain. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is an enormous expense. Currently, people bring their own cars and they pay them pennies on the dollar for doing the job for them.
Yeah.
It will always be cheaper to underpay real humans to do your dirty work than it'll be to maintain your own fleet of robot cars.
Yeah.
So as a business proposition, like at the time we could have looked at Uber and said, actually, they're not going to do that. It took us a couple of years to all realize the truth. And I wonder if the same thing is going to happen with, you know, certain areas where people say that the language models or the AI models are going to beat us. Well, won't it still be cheaper to pay like some of the many billions of people alive on the planet nothing to do it for you and trick them into it?
Yeah, I think a big thing that we're going to see a lot of stories about coming in the next year are going to be products that are like AI powered. And then, I mean, we've already had a couple of these, but there's going to be more of like, it's like, oh, it's AI powered. And then it turns out that the AI is a sweatshop.
Yeah, yeah. And some, they already seem like that to some degree where, you know, ChatGPT currently and has to run all of its output through, you know, people in Kenya or whatever who are doing the filtering for them.
Yeah.
Which is the case with Facebook and basically any other user generated content site they're doing that with. There's also going to be a lot of relabeling existing stuff as AI
generated.
A friend of mine was just like, oh my God, my friend just switched from her stockbroker to an AI stockbroker. Stockbrokers are out of a job. And I was like, that's called a Vanguard account. Like I've had one of those for almost 10 years.
Yeah.
Like that Betterment does that. Wealthfront does that. Like that's a very common, you know, that already existed. The fact that they now say AI on their landing page doesn't mean anything has changed.
Yeah. So we're going to see a lot of hollow rebranding, a lot of, oops, it's actually slavery. You know, I mean, like just to go back to the Uber thing, like I knew that they were never going to do the robot car thing because it's like, no, their entire business model, the entire thing that made them like the evil brilliance of Uber as a bad idea is that they don't own any cars.
Yeah.
And thus they don't have the liability of owning cars.
Yeah.
They offloaded that onto other people. And it's like, they're not going to suddenly decide to go legit and like own cars because their entire business model, they make fabulous amount of money off of the fact that they can run a taxi service without owning a single car.
Yeah. Or assuming any of the legal liability of the car hitting people, of paying for the gas, of paying for the depreciation on the car, doing anything.
That was their winning formula was, wait, what if we could run taxis without owning cars? And they made $1 billion.
I've actually heard of this argument as being an explanation for the entire tech boom, including the part of the tech boom that worked. Right. Where that actually made products, which is that these are companies that what created the entire startup culture. It's that the startup costs of a tech company are much lower than any other type of company in American history, that you don't need to like create a steel mill or, you know, start fabricating paper clips or whatever. You literally just rent some, you know, data services from Amazon, hire a couple coders who you pay very well. And then, you know, you can undermine an existing business with a very low cost. And so it almost looks like to me, the various phenomena that you have been unpacking in your videos, crypto, the metaverse, et cetera, is an attempt to just keep that rolling, keep that same sort of ahistorical engine afloat when maybe they've already picked all the low hanging fruit off of it. And there aren't that many more opportunities that you can do that cheaply. I don't know.
Possibly. So one of the a phrase that I've been seeing around lately is that it's like the 2030s are going to be a process of reckoning of just how much of the 21st century was built by low interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
That like venture capital or like just all of the different financial instruments that allowed venture capitalists to access extremely low interest money has enabled some really good and interesting things, and a lot of just like it has enabled a bunch of people to sit around and brainstorm how can we get our customers to do our job for us and thank us for the privilege.
Yeah. And let's unpack that a little bit because I'm learning what we mean by low interest when we're talking about that. We're saying the government kept literal government bond interest rates very low for a very long time.
Yeah.
Which means if you wanted to beat that rate, you don't have to offer lenders very much money. You can say, hey, let you know, you're not going to get a big return from the government, so give me your money instead. And I don't need to promise you that much. But in a world where the government is offering people 5 or 7% interest rates,
yeah,
suddenly it's a lot harder to borrow money. Because that money is going to the government instead,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
And so it creates this bizarre scenario where you can borrow money to do bullshit.
Yeah. And like, there's a certain amount of like, it's like, okay, the world needs, you know, it's not a bad thing if randos have access to capital to try bad ideas. But there's also like limits on that and limits on how much power those people should ultimately be given. And like, maybe there needs to be a faster response to like, hey, these things are actually like socially impactful, or just, you know, more people in power who can go like, you actually just built a taxi service where you don't own any taxis and your users pay to like, what's going on here? What's going on here? Because yeah, like, who are your actual end? Who are Uber's actual end users? Who are their target market? And it's actually their drivers.
Yeah.
And yep, it's like, you're doing something here that, you know, maybe we should tamp on that. Now, I was actually proud of like my city, Calgary, like had a very strict regulations on car sharing, like from the word, basically from the word go of like, no, you're a taxi service. Yep. And so it's far less prevalent up here, but that also means that like the people who are doing it, you know, the rates are a lot more like actually competitive towards, you know, like livable. Yep. Because like that's just the reality of it. But they had to crowdsource that. Like, in order to get Uber rates as low as they did, they needed just a unfathomable oversupply of drivers. They needed, yeah, vastly more drivers than there were people who needed rides. And yeah. Yeah.
And that model is starting to sort of bite them in the ass to a certain extent.
Yeah. Because it's unsustainable. Because, like, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because everybody at this point, so many people have driven Uber for long enough to realize they weren't making money and have stopped.
Yeah.
They, you know, the sort of average Uber driver has sort of fallen off. People used, you know, I have so many friends who, I drove Uber for 2 weeks, then I quit. Right. So who's left doing it? It's folks who are frankly often in poverty,
yeah,
right? Who are Uber drivers. And that turns out to be an uncomfortable riding experience for a lot of Uber customers, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like people don't want
to get in a car with a clearly desperate person who is,
yeah,
like visibly on their last thread.
Yeah.
And just like, yeah.
It's not nice. You feel, you're like, oh, sure, I want to go to the bar for a night out, but first I have to like confront the reality of wealth inequality in America to do so. It's not a nice riding experience.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so now there's actually services popping up that are still app-based services, but they own all the cars and they pay all the drivers, at least here in California, California minimum wage, because they realize that the, you know, there's a huge market of people who want to take a better version of, who actually want to take a cab again,
yeah,
you know, basically. You know, you're starting to sort of see Uber grapple with that. Hopefully you'll start to see some of these other companies grapple with this too. When you look at a, you know, a company like TikTok that is making their money off of Chum, maybe at some point they, you know, they realize, oh wait, they need to foster some better, you know, some better style of content by actually paying people or et cetera. I don't know. I hope that the contradictions inherent eventually start taking down some of these companies or causing them to change. Maybe, maybe not.
But. Yeah. I think the contradictions are going to come a lot faster for like those that deal, like for the companies that deal in like physical stuff. So like Uber,
right,
has, you know, physical capital that they need to deal with. They've got human, you know, they've got a human dimension. The other big one, of course, is like Airbnb, you know, the hotel chain,
yep,
that owns no hotels. And I think those are the ones that are going to see the reckoning like sooner. Uber in particular, and like Skip the Dishes and Uber Eats and like the delivery apps are going, like they have oh boy, I follow a couple of the subreddits for these. And there's a whole culture of what's called multi-apping, where it's like, oh, like what you do is you just work for like all of these simultaneously. And if you're savvy or desperate, you can like juggle these. You can pick up a ride, be like, take them to a McDonald's, grab a delivery, and like try and do like both at the same time on two different, you know, you have like three, four different phones, you know, do like, you know, and on one hand, it's like, oh, it's like it's courtesy to like pause your other ones while you're like on a job, but like you don't need to pause your other ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can try to like juggle all these. And there's a lot of people doing that. And it is, of course, like people who are desperate. And thus service is like bad because it turns out that they're overworking themselves. They're trying to do an impossible task of like, because they're sitting there staring at an app and the app is just throwing at them basically like randomly generated tasks for all intents and purposes. And you are blind to the like outcome of that. It's like, here's a job for you. Do you want to take it? But you're not actually given like a full disclosure of like what the job entails. Like you don't get to see the full instructions before you accept it. And so it's like, it's a little surprise. You click, it's like, yes, take the job. I'm near the starting point. And it's not until you like commit to that, that it's then like, oh, the person wants you to like drive all the way over here. In order to like, you know,
And so then you fuck with the app a little bit. You have your little scheme for bargaining with it or for doing two things at once.
Yeah.
And which is natural to do when a human encounters a system like that. But then that reduces the quality of the experience for the user. Like, okay, so I'm on the road a lot as a comic and I live on the West Coast. So I travel to the East Coast. I often get in very late and I get in hungry. And so I get to my hotel and literally the only option, because sometimes I'm staying in a weird place, is DoorDash or Uber Eats.
Yeah.
And it's a horrible experience. You know, it's like those services can be nice if you're in a big city, but if you're in, if you're in the suburb of a second or third, you know, level city in America,
you can say Cleveland. This is a safe space. You can say Cleveland.
I like those cities, but they're not, you know, you're not in the middle of like some thriving food culture, right? You're somewhere out, you know. You open these services and you can get delivered fast food or ghost kitchens, right? You're like looking at this going, it's like, you know, number one pizza spot. And you're like, that's not a fucking pizzeria. Like I've ordered from places like that before. I've seen these photos before. I know I'm going to get a horrible meal. And if you order, you're like, I don't know if this person is going to bring me the food. Like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to find them. It's like this weird roll of the dice. And it's sort of similar to, I don't order shit on Amazon anymore because I no longer trust Amazon to deliver me the thing. It used to be, I'd get the genuine version of the product. Now I'm like, it'll be a knockoff. It'll never show up. Like, because they have crowdsourced it too widely. I see a similar thing happening with the delivery apps for the very reason that you mentioned. And it's almost because humans, like, they've created this Skinner box for us to work within. Like literally it's, as you say, these constant just alerts that these workers are getting. But the workers are still people who are going to use their human faculties to try to fuck around with the system.
To try to like,
exploit, just like the guy talking to the NPC.
To get one up over it. They're going to try to win, you know, and especially because like the systems rely so much on like gamification, you know, Uber relies so much on its gamified elements with the app. Robinhood, the day trading app, like it is hyper gamified. But the thing is it's like once you introduce those gamification elements, you introduce them in order to addict the user. And then shocked Pikachu face, they approach it like a game and they look for the cracks in the rules. They run along the walls, you know, hammering spacebar, looking for a break in the collision box so they can get behind the terrain and cut 10 minutes off of their time. So it's like, oh, well, I can just have it's like. Well, people won't, you sit there in the office and go like, oh, well, we'll just ensure that only like one phone number can be like valid at a time. And the person on the other end just goes like, okay, So I can get a prepay account for like $15 a month. So I only need to do 2-3 jobs on that second phone in order for that phone to pay itself off. And then everything above that is profit on phone number 2, ditto for phones number 3 and 4.
And those uses are never, they're never in the tech demo that the CEO gives of here's how great this is going to be.
Yeah, they never like, here's the dude with a clipboard of iPhones, all active at the same time, going out to like a giant bat, like with cords going out to a giant battery pack that he keeps in a backpack. You know, yeah, yep. Like that part doesn't end up on stage. Yeah.
Look, man, I could talk to you for 1,000 years, and so I hope you'll come back sometime. Next time you have another big video that we can about a new topic. But let me just ask you this: as a fellow person who has devoted at least some of his career to dispelling bullshit of this type. How do you feel about it? Do you feel ultimately heartened because there's a never ending supply of bullshit that you can dispel and get a lot of views on YouTube from, and you know, you're a happy warrior about it? Or do you feel like, hey, you make this video about the metaverse, last year made a video about crypto, next year you'll have to make a video about whatever the fuck they come up with after AI? And like, oh my God, people never learn. You know, like, are you going to end up like Jon Stewart quitting after 20 years, realizing, hold on a second, Fox and Friends is still on the fucking air. I've been tilting at this windmill for a long time. I never make any progress. You know, like, are you Sisyphus, or are you happier than that?
I'm tired. Yeah, I get tired. Okay. I alternate between the two. I'm ultimately an optimist, but I'm a very cynical optimist. I think that people are willing to defend themselves in the long run. I think that people are savvy enough to realize when systems are destructive and mm-hmm. demand changes to those systems. But I'm also cynical about like the willingness of those the willingness of the firstborn sons of Ski-Doo dealership owners, Ski-Doo dealerships to invent Uber for cats. Invent like there's these guys I've been keeping track of, that their whole tech thing is like, what if you could rent T-shirts that are delivered to you via not pneumatic tube, but like a robot in a 12-inch pipe. And and they have this whole pitch package, and they're getting money for it. And I'm like, I see it, and I'm like, your entire product is going to be instantly destroyed by a $5 buy a $5 hot and ready Little Caesars pepperoni pizza that I am going to shove into the mouth of your pipe and destroy your robot. And that's before we get to the fact that no one wants to rent a T-shirt.
Why are you renting it? I don't even know if we can get into it. Renting a T-shirt. No, it sounds very similar to the bird scooters, right?
Yeah. Where,
like, oh, this is how everyone's going to get around. Well, you forgot that 13-year-olds are going to throw them into the river.
Throw them into the river. Yeah. And 35-year-olds are also going to throw them into the river because you're stealing public sidewalk space, and your business model relies on the fact that, like, you do not need to pay leases for land, like, to put your junk on.
Yeah.
That you have decided that, like, oh, I can just park, like, I can just roll up a van and dump 5 of these on the side of the road, and that's fine because it's public. I can just abuse the commons. And it's like, well, if you want to abuse the commons, I'm going to chuck your stuff into the river.
And bullshit like that is always going to keep existing. I think it's part of the human condition that new people are going to try to take advantage that way and are going to be that stupid. But I share your optimism that most people are smart enough to see through it. That's why people are chucking the scooters in the river, is because they see through the bullshit and they're pissed off. That's why people, I think, are going to reject AI chum art for the most part. Maybe there'll be a little bit of it they'll enjoy, but people.
Yeah. By volume, there will be an astounding amount of it, but the video stuff service, I think will be curtailed by the actual like processing costs.
I mean, I think some services are going to have to like start banning AI shit because their users are going to say we don't want it. And they're going to promote themselves as we're only human generated content here. Yeah. Like that is, people are going to be able to tell the difference. And I agree with your optimism because the success of your videos proves there's an enormous appetite for skepticism and, you know, human reasoning about these things. So I really thank you for being here. Where can people find your work, Dan, if they haven't already seen it?
So you can find it on YouTube. The channel name is Folding Ideas, and you can find my insane ramblings on social media, like basically most of the platforms at Foldable Human.
And I hope people check it out because it's amazing work. Thank you so much for being here, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much again to Dan for coming on the show. That was such a fun conversation. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you did, remember, you can support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/AdamConover. I want to thank everybody especially who supports at the $15 a month level. Recently, subscribing at that level, we've had The Spicy, Nick Frazier, Transient Astronomer, Ken Runner, Rebecca Bea, Andy Smith, Christopher Wheeler, Danny Odell, and MiskBits. I'll leave it to you to figure out which of those names are real and which ones are internet handles. But thank you so much to everybody for subscribing. And I also want to thank Tony Wilson and Sam Roudman for producing this show with me, everyone here at HeadGum for helping make this show possible. And you can find me online at adamconover.net or at adamconover, wherever you get your social media. If you want to come see me on tour in Illinois, Maryland, Missouri, or Rhode Island, head to adamconover.net/tour dates. I'll see you next week. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next time on Factually.
That was a HeadGum podcast.